This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right, Dr. Lyle, Happy New Year.
Hey, you too, Nate. Good to hear you.
Yeah, how are you? How was your New Year?
All good. Tame. At my age, nothing exciting happens, but it's good to be here for another year.
You sound like my grandpa.
You got it. Well, getting there.
Yeah. Well, so today's show, we're talking about the point of psychotherapy and psychology. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends sent me a clip about a psychologist. I was telling him about the show, and it reminded mm-hmm. him of this little clip. It's a satire clip with Bob Newhart. So let's listen in really mm-hmm. quickly. And then, we've got a caller on the line, so we're going to take a call after that, too. So.
Very good.
Dr. Switzer?
Yes, come in. I'm just washing my hands.
I'm Catherine Bigman. Janet Carlisle referred me.
Oh, yes. Still being buried alive in a box.
Yes, that's me. Should I lay down?
Oh, no, we don't do that anymore. Just have a seat. And let me tell you a bit about our billing. I charge $5 for the first 5 minutes, and then absolutely nothing after that.
That sounds great. Too good to be true, as a matter of fact.
Well, I can almost guarantee you that our session won't last the full 5 minutes. Now, we don't do any insurance billing, so you would either have to pay in cash or by check.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't make change.
All right.
Go.
Go.
Well, tell me about the problem that you wish to address.
Oh, okay. Well, I have this fear of being buried alive in a box. I start thinking about being buried alive, and I begin to panic.
Has anyone ever tried to bury you alive in a box?
No, but truly thinking about it does make my life horrible. I mean, I can't go through tunnels or be in an elevator or in a house, anything boxy.
So what you're saying is you're claustrophobic.
Yes, that's it.
All right, well, let's go, Catherine. I'm going to say two words to you right now. I want you to listen to them very, very carefully. Then I want you to take them out of the office with you and incorporate them into your life.
Well, shall I write them down?
Well, if it makes you comfortable, it's just two words. Most people can remember them.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Okay, here they are.
Stop it! I'm sorry?
Stop it!
Stop it?
Yes. S-T-O-P, new word, I-T.
So, what are you saying?
You know, it's funny. I say two simple words, and I cannot tell you the amount of people who say exactly the same thing you're saying. I mean, this is not Yiddish, Catherine. This is English. Stop it.
So I should just stop it.
There you go. I mean, you don't want to go through life being scared of being buried alive in a box, do you? I mean, that Sounds frightening. Then stop it!
I can't. I mean, it's been with me since childhood.
No, we don't go there. Just stop it.
So I should just stop being afraid of being buried alive in a box.
You got it. Good go. Well, it's only been 3 minutes, so that will be $3.
All right, Dr. Lau.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great. But we'll get a comment for you in just a second about it. We have a caller online, caller named Lee. So, Lee, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. I called several months ago as well, so I don't want to be that person, but I just wanted
to. No, very good. Actually, your voice is a bit familiar. I can't remember exactly what the circumstances were, but glad to have you back.
Thank you. This is a totally unrelated question.
Sure.
So I wanted to kind of hear your thoughts about the science of learning. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a lot of what you talk about touched on that meaningfully in a variety of different contexts. Mm-hmm. So here's sort of some of my takeaways from what you have and why it's leading me to that question.
Yeah.
So I think a few weeks ago, about the show about change and willpower, mm-hmm. it seemed to conclude that in order to make meaningful change, you need to change your inputs, mm-hmm. materially change your inputs in a way that would actually change this complex mechanism we have for analyzing the choices for the statistically optimal outcomes, as you put it. Mm-hmm. So meaning like we need to learn and absorb new things, even if they're counter, and especially if they're counter to the schema that we already rely on, and probably that schema is already giving us comfort or satisfaction, or you know, however you want to put that. And, you know, a while back you also talked about the informational immune system and some of the interesting roots of that and shortcuts that we might have or mistakes that we might be making in terms of seeking out useful information. And even when you talked about trauma, I sort of heard that in the same way, right, in terms of, like, trauma as a way to sort of cement your learning on certain things. So then with last week's show, it was kind of becoming clear that some of the existing theories out there, like the sort of behavioral model, don't quite get it. So how does evolutionary psychology approach this? I mean, it seems like this is a core question, right? If the key to beating your genes mm-hmm. is understanding what's going on at this broader theoretical level, applying the theory, identifying and solving the problems where our genes might be leading us away from the best choices for our happiness, then this mm-hmm. is something that we need to understand. So then here's my specific question.
Yeah.
How do we best get people to learn information that's accurate, nuanced, mm-hmm. difficult, complex, traumatic, or otherwise destabilizing, and that requires sustained attention, especially when that information is key to significantly changing values and or actions, right? It seems extremely complex and like you could kind of go astray at any one of those points. Mm-hmm. So I know that, you know, you've also talked about personality and some of the other issues, and I'm sure that those things are very much related, but mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of hear more directly about that.
Right. This is really good, deep thinking. And so let me see if I can, see if we can lead you a direction that then you can ask questions along the way and make sure that how it is that, you know, let's see if we can, if I can communicate this. The what the nervous system is it's, for all intents and purposes, it's a bag of tricks. And what these tricks do is that they're little computational devices. And they were designed to take specific inputs and to then come up with, have a pathway of information processing that would lead to the optimal solution for behavior in the environment of our ancestry. So let me give you an example of how this would work. So let's suppose you're a young man and you are strolling along in the moonlight headed towards your cabin, and it's, I don't know, maybe it's Western Massachusetts in 1880. And you belong to this little village area, and there's a girl there that you've just got to be recently sweet on. And there's another guy that's been sweet on her, and he's been there longer in that town than you have. Or he knew her before you knew her. But now there's some flirtation going back between the two of you, you and the young lady. And now you're walking in the woods to your parents' cabin, and you hear a twig snap, relatively large twig snap. Now, let's look at what's happening inside the brain. So what's happening is that the first thing that's going to happen is your mind has been drifting about thinking about that female and thinking about how it is that you're going to have sex with her one day. So that's actually what's been drifting through that guy's head as he's on that walk in the moonlight. Now, as soon as he hears the twig snap, what we notice is if we looked inside of his mind, we would find that his emotional experience now shifts dramatically. And like I said, it had to be a big enough twig snap. If it was a tiny little twig snap, it might not do this. A big twig snaps only when there's been a substantial weight put on it. So his brain is sophisticated enough to infer that it's the size of an animal or the force that was put on a twig is responsible for the sound that you hear. So his brain has specialized circuits that were designed by evolution in order to make accurate inferences about the size of forces that needed to cause certain sounds, the amount of sound that you would get out of some kind of activity. So what's going to happen is that he's going to have an emotion that we're going to call fear. And because he's going to have that emotion, what's going to happen is, what emotions are is they are essentially specialized programs that are in the computer. The brain is a very, very sophisticated computer, many, many orders of magnitude more sophisticated than any computer that we can build. And what this computer does is what it's going to do is it will shut down a whole bunch of other programs. So right now he had some food that he had eaten an hour ago that he's been digesting, and that digestion process is being partially regulated by the brain as it contracts the stomach muscles in order for him to mechanically break apart the food. But as soon as he hears the twig snap, that digestion will cease. That program will shut down the digestive program. It will also shut down the program that is around plotting how it is that he's going to get into that female's sexuality. That program is now, those programs are now shut down. And what's happening now, he's not thinking about that he's planning on maybe trying to ask old Horace for money to go to college nearby at Amherst. That's out. He's not thinking about that. Not thinking about his future. He's not thinking about anything. What happens is his mind immediately goes to the problem of what was that sound? What caused it? Okay. Now what we're going to see is that his mind is going to drift towards what I'm going to call the worst case scenario. And the reason why it's going to do this is that it's been shaped by evolution to actually make certain inferences. And the inferences that it makes are not designed to be the most accurate inferences. They are designed to be the inferences that are the most adaptive. In other words, it's the animal that makes the inferences of certain types that wind up being the most beneficial in terms of resulting in the greatest amount of genes being on the planet. So the mind is not designed to maximize accuracy. It is designed to maximize gene survival. So literally the thinking that the animal does, in this case it's a human, the thinking that it does is actually guided by specialized circuits So this is in response to some of what you were trying to say, and so I'm trying to like get it a little clearer for you. There isn't a thing that we're going to call, quote, reason. What there is that there's specialized circuits that are designed by nature to make certain inferences under conditions of certain inputs. So now we're starting to see just how specialized the activities of the mind are. They are unbelievably specialized. So a certain input under certain conditions winds up with this individual making certain inferences. And those certain inferences now lead to a whole host of information seeking, and memory devices are now invoked. So now he's thinking about that this other young man and his friend actually gave him a long, ugly look a couple days ago. Okay, and he realized that when he was in town, it was a little disturbing, the stare that he got. Okay, so now that is now in his computations, and now he's thinking about that. You know, it wasn't but a month ago that he climbed a tree along this path somewhere very close by, and he knows that it was relatively easy for him to do it, and he can remember how it is that he did it. So he's immediately, what he does is he starts categorizing his knowledge of the existing environment as his memory circuits are activated into different locations that are going to be called danger or safe, okay? So he's very rapidly searching through the memory banks looking for locations that say safe, and he's looking for that with respect to his current location, and he's analyzing this with respect to the direction that apparently that the sound came from, okay? So now it's going to turn out that we will watch him. He will contract certain muscles in his upper body around his neck that will lead him to move his head from side to side very quickly as he's essentially trying to triangulate on the noise. We're also going to find that different auditory systems will actually increase their sensitivity, so that he is much more likely to hear sounds, even of the same decibel level, than he would have had he not had this twig snap and invoking all of this machinery. So this is typical. So this is actually what's going on in human life all the time, in animal life. In other words, extraordinary sophistication of circuitry is essentially coordinating behavior in a way that seems miraculous, and it is of course unbelievably sophisticated. So you have this is the equivalent of something that we can't really build worth a damn now. This is a parallel computer. This is a computer that's designed by nature to use parallel computers that are all hooked up together in a network, and all of them they have decision rules that guide these activations and that will lead ultimately to behavior that over the course of the natural history of the species, in sum, is the most successful behavior that we can get given the conditions that have been presented to the nervous system. Now, so what is learning? Okay, so what learning is an updating of information in memory. So as we see, had he never been on this path before, he wouldn't know about that tree that he might be able to climb. And had he never climbed the tree, he wouldn't be thinking about this. You wouldn't think about it as easily. So the fact that he's been on this path before and he has climbed this tree actually improve his accuracy about the nature of his relationship between himself and the environment. So if he did not have that in his head, if he didn't have that knowledge in his head, then this is what I would call a distortion. So he might be thinking there's nowhere to run or to hide. He can't see how he would do it. But if he has that information in his head about that tree, then his mind is less distorted than it is without that information. So obviously, all animal minds at all times are operating under distortion. The only question is, how much distortion do they have? And distortions are ultimately the cause of unnecessary unpleasantness in the life of any animal. So there are lives in animals, there are situations that we are not distorted, and there is necessary unpleasantness. So if a great white shark is grasping your legs as you fell off your surfboard, you're having an incredibly unpleasant situation, and there's nothing distorted about it. Okay, but the real issue is, if you're all in a knot and upset about the fact that your boss just passed you over for a promotion, the question is whether or not any of the neural circuits that are being activated in your head are actually distortions, or they're based on you're having a distorted reaction that is therefore unnecessary, and whether more information about the situation will actually reduce your suffering, or, for example, reduce the errors that you might make in your subsequent behavior. So let me see about where we are now. So what we're going to do is we're going to recognize when I see an individual that is suffering, they are usually not suffering. This isn't the first moment that they had this emotional response about this condition. In other words, they've had many, many emotional responses about this same situational setup in their life. Maybe it's, for example, relationship between me and potential mates. So it turns out that they're repetitively frustrated, and they are with respect to that problem, and they are then depressed and intermittently depressed and angry and hopeless. Okay, so I hear about what those emotional responses are, and I recognize that those are hallmarks of an individual who has some distortions that are very likely to be present in their reasoning about these situations. And my job is to figure out how to remove the distortions. Now, so what learning is it's going to be the removal of distortion. So if you are learning, for example, about addition, and you make mistakes, then and you think that 2 + 3 = 6, then that's a distortion, and you will make mistakes behind that with respect to real life things. How many clams are in the basket? I had 2 in that basket and 3 in that basket. So when I got home, how come I don't see 6? I only see 5. So you can see that distortions lead to potentially to errors that may result in unnecessary unpleasantness, i.e. biological failure with respect to something. So our job as psychologists in psychotherapy is actually to remove distortions, because in the removal of distortions, we make the behavior of the individual relatively more successful. We can't remove all distortions. That's impossible in principle. But what we can do is we can remove distortions to the point where the individual is more successful and therefore suffering less. So is that making sense so far?
Yeah. Okay. I have sort of 2 questions or thoughts based on that, 2 areas
Sure. That
I see potential issues. One is, it sounds like basically all of the calculation, all of the memory triggering and sort of evaluation of the risk and all of that is done in service of the emotion.
Slow down. When you say in service of, I'm not sure what you mean.
So by that, I mean, you started out your sort of hypothetical by saying that you've got this person who is sort of walking along kind of occupied by one problem, and then another problem may cross his mind, and then everything gets sort of subsumed under this fear that's triggered by the branch, right? So
yeah.
Well, that's the sort of top one. Yeah,
yeah, let's let's just be, just for the sake, just to keep clear, the it isn't that all other systems in the brain are shut down. It's that the way this is going to work is that it's going to work that there's going to be the thing is smart enough to know that there are priorities and that it actually can inherently know what those priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
So it immediately shuts down cognitive processing about a whole bunch of other things that are part of this individual's life, and it focuses its attention on those things that are essentially the most important variables with respect to its gene survival. Okay.
Go ahead.
So hopefully that makes sense. In other words, it's clever enough to assign priorities.
So it sounds like if you are hoping to persuade someone or explain something to someone that's complex or difficult, your first task is basically becoming their priority.
Well, wait a second. Slow down. If I'm going to try to convince somebody of something complex or difficult, the thing is the first thing that we're trying to do is to help them see a connection between what it is that they're about to learn and what the benefit it is for them.
Right.
So
that's what I'm saying,
right.
I guess. So and that has to be competing with the other things that are sort of vying for their attention cognitive processing. Okay.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like that's sort of your first task.
Yes.
And I think that there are certain types of information that have importance but are more abstract and just by nature are going to be, you know, at a disadvantage in terms of grabbing that kind of attention. I mean,
no question. In other words, there's certain types of human beings are built to essentially be able to use their imaginations and to think about things that they use images that are essentially replays of existing sensory events that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can speak to and give them pictures in their mind about sensory events that they've had or that they could easily imagine, and that
mm-hmm.
you can explain why it is that what it is that you're proposing may help them be more successful with respect to decision-making in that area, then you're going to have their attention.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? Whereas if you're trying to, as you say, if you get too abstract, very very smart people can see the point of the use of correcting a mistaken principle that you have learned that is in fact wrong. Okay. So if you had learned, for example, that the nervous system was tabula rasa, and that essentially the brain was an association device, and that neurons that fire together wire together. Okay, if this is how it is that you had learned what you believed to be true about the nervous system of humans and animals, and that this was the nature of the psychology of organisms, and then I started explaining to you that was not true. Okay, now most people couldn't care less. But if you are a very high-level psychologist and I started explaining to you, oh, no, actually, what you're talking about is incorrect. And let me explain to you what the evidence is that that's incorrect so that you can see that in principle there's something horrendously wrong with how it is you've been trying to organize the information. And so a person in principle there could be fascinated and extremely motivated to learn something that seems very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that's going to be unusual. Most people, it's going to need to be, how are they going to get laid easier, better, be more attractive, you know, live in a nicer place, get paid more money, have more friends, be more secure, etc. Lie on the beach more in Hawaii. These are going to be the kinds of things that are going to get people's attention.
Okay, and by their very nature, certain sorts of concepts are going to be at a disadvantage in competing for that kind of attention.
Yeah, certain kinds of problems, human beings are already pre-wired to think in ways that are quite accurate, and certain kinds of problems are going to be very difficult and extremely counterintuitive.
And that's where my sort of question came from.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So that's helpful to kind of, walk that all back.
Right. Good. Okay.
The other thing that that as you were talking about the distortions, I would assume that there are, and I think you've sort of said as much in the past, that there are normal things we can expect people to do that are going to be distorting, basically like traps or mistakes that people mm-hmm. regularly make, counterintuitive facts that people use their intuition badly on.
Right.
So given what you've talked about, things like the informational immune system, people who maybe mm-hmm. are less open to new ideas or status issues, ego trap issues, I mean, how do you basically say, no, wait, your calculation is wrong, and then sort of open them up for the data dump, basically? I mean, it sounds like, I'll tell you, like, one sort of thought that I have is that people seem to kind of compartmentalize, like, oh, well, learning is for school. And if they're not in an environment where the culture is to learn and be open-minded to things and to really kind of persist on learning some of these things, they may just be more inclined to not really take that or not be used to kind of walking back some of their mistakes.
Mm. Well, actually, the truth is that when people are making mistakes, if they're costly enough, they're feeling it. So they feel it in things like depression, anxiety, hopelessness, et cetera. In other words, so if their distortions are significant enough, they're in trouble. So it could be that they're addicted, so they're suffering behind, they're overweight, they're out of shape, they're addicted to some kind of substance, et cetera. That's a whole set of traps. Or they're getting rejected a lot in the romantic arena, or they are getting rejected a lot in the commercial trading arena, et cetera, for work and et cetera. So in other words, people come to me as a psychologist when they're in trouble. Okay, so they're in trouble. They're very motivated. They're looking for a solution. Okay, and so at that point, they're highly motivated to learn, and they may come in. It was less common nowadays, but in the early days, people would come in occasionally expecting a very different therapeutic style than they would get. So I only had this happen a few times, but I had some people coming in and saying, well, I assume you're a spiritual good person. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not spiritual. Okay, so I'm pleasant enough, okay, and I'm a good person in the sense that I'm very much out to make this a win-win situation, that I want them to be successful, and therefore that's in my best interest. So however, what we may wind up doing might be an awful lot different than they thought was going to happen. So they might thought that they were going to come in and bitch about how it is that their parents are not being fair because they're not paying enough for their wedding. That was one that happened about 20 years ago that I can remember. But most of the time, they come in reasonably uncertain about what this process is going to be like, even though if they've been in therapy before, they understand that every person, therefore every therapist, is going to be different. And so they're naturally socialized to a consultative situation. They've sat down with people or a friend or people to talk through problems before, so they're not going to be too shocked about what's going to happen. But what we're going to do, though, is that I'm going to simply ask people what's going on and what seems to be the trouble, and they're going to tell me. And as they tell me, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be thinking through what distortions that I believe are driving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what I'm going to be doing is the next thing I'll do, usually in less than 15 minutes, usually 10 minutes or between 10 and 15 minutes into the first therapy session, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be drawing them a little picture of human life. And so you can see these pictures and how it is that I do this. If you go to Dr. McDougall's website, and I've done a series of webinars there, and they're free. Anybody can see these. And it's at drmcdougall.com. These webinars, he has a whole slew of them. They're all about health. But the ones that I do are very psychological. And so there's a number of them that I did in the spring of 2016. And I will use the same types of pictures. I think one of them is called The Slow Fast Way, and another one is called probably Dare to Be Lousy. And another one may be called The Continuum of Evil. I can't remember. But if you look at these things, what you're going to find is a little set of pictures. And in the set of pictures, I start out with a little character, a little person, a stick figure about an inch tall in the middle of a paper. And that's the individual, essentially the individual that we're talking about. But I'll call this individual, you know, Sharon or Janie or somebody like that. And then what I talk about is I talk about that above them, in the middle of the page and the far left and the far right, there's three groups of people. And the three groups of people are going to be potential mates, potential friends, and potential trading partners. Those are the three markets of human life. These are the three classes of relationships that define the competitive problems of humanity. There's a fourth class of people that are critical in human life. We're going to call those family. But you don't necessarily compete with family. So if you're somebody's mother, you don't have to compete to be their mother. You just are. So the three other classes of relationships, romance, friendships, and trade, those comprise the top priorities of human life. And so then what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about how inside Janie's mind is going to be a device that we're going to call the esteem meter. And this is a device that is tracking the problems of competition and advertising feedback. So when you are trying to secure a mate, or if you already have a mate, you are always advertising. And that, which means that you are under either real competition or what we're going to call theoretical competition. So even if you are in a solid pair bond and getting great feedback from your mate, you are still in a competitive situation. So your mate still has options, and those options are very similar to you in terms of gene quality, and or else they wouldn't be your mate. And so as a result, you know you have competitive problems, which means that your mate is running cost-benefit analysis on you just as you're running cost-benefit analysis on him. And if you don't have a mate, you are much more acutely conscious of the fact that potential mates are running cost-benefit analysis on you, just as you are aware that you're running cost-benefit analysis on them. And so these are the competitive problems of human life, and these are the three markets that define human interest. And so as a result of this, when people are unhappy consistently in their life, if they're consistently if they're lonely, that's a signaling device that tells you that you are not getting as much social connection as would have been consistent with optimal gene survival in the natural history of the species. If you are being romantic love loneliness in the sense and also feeling depressed around this, then it's telling me that your efforts in this arena have been met with somewhat surprising rejection. The nature of depression and certain other emotional responses, embarrassment is one of these, actually joyful happiness is one of these. These are going to be what we call recalibration systems. And the purpose of them is to essentially alert and reorganize expectations so that resources, the time and energy of the organism is utilized more effectively. So if a person is depressed, that is telling me that they are experiencing failure feedback in one or more of these competitive domains. And the feedback that they're getting is surprising to them at some level. In other words, they don't understand why it is that they're getting the feedback that they're getting. And you might say, well, is that really true? Well, yeah, you know, you got a degree from Swarthmore in French art history, and you thought you were going to make $48,000 a year working for PBS, and it turns out that nobody wants to hire you. And so now you're depressed. And you might say, well, you know, that's really bad. You know, this is an objective, serious problem here. Well, I'm not exactly sure why, because the truth of the matter is that the person is still qualified to get a job at Starbucks, and they could get one, but they're not interested in that job. And it's depressing for them to even think about that job. And the reason it's not depressing for a 17-year-old high school student to think about that job, but it's depressing for a Swarthmore graduate to think about that job. And that's because she has expectations for what it is that she's going to be able to trade for. So it is the failure feedback relative to expectations which will drive emotional response. It will just drive what we're going to call depression. And so what's happening is that the nervous system, when you're depressed, it's a signaling device that tells you that you have been uncompetitive, that your advertisement is uncompetitive, or you could be miscalibrated as to what it is that you have to trade. So this means it's a problem. It means there's a suspicion that we are not understanding how to optimally allocate our time and energy, okay? In the same way, so it's causing recalibration processes. In other words, it's causing information seeking to try to find out alternative ways to compete. It's also causing systems to shut down and not put further energy into the ways that we're trying to compete now. In other words, it can cause a person to, quote, feel hopeless. These are all mechanisms that are also associated with reducing their sense of self-esteem, which will actually reduce and recalibrate what targets would feel reasonable for them to approach and to be excited about approaching. So this is you can imagine a screwed up little high school student guy who's a five, who has normal chips for analyzing female beauty and general attractiveness, and would like to take the prom queen out, but he asks her and she says no, and then the second most attractive girl in school says no, and the third one says no, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, he eventually will find out where he's calibrated at. But he's going to have his estimations of what he qualifies for go through an adaptive process where his expectations are lowered for him to be excited about Mabel, who's a five. Okay, that's how that has to take place. So the same thing is going to be true of many other emotions. For example, guilt is a reassessment or reorganization, a recalibration device that tells the individual that they may have been too self-serving with respect to conflicts of interest between them and another person or an institution. And so they have been unfair, and therefore what they need to do is they need to change their behavior in the future in order to be more generous with their time or energy. So as to protect their position and not get kicked out of the coalition or to not have the trading relationship eliminated, okay? So if you've been doing a flaky job at your job, you are starting to feel a little bit guilty, but that's a signaling device to tell you that you are at risk of being fired, okay? And so therefore guilt, this is an adaptive emotion to try to help you recalibrate your expenditure of time and energy so that you actually make optimal decisions for gene survival. The same thing is true with excited joy. You know, the very great excitement that is the peak experiences of the moods of happiness for us. And that is that when you are extremely excited about something, a new love relationship or a new job that you got or a sale at Macy's, a great deal on a used car, the great excitement that you have is actually a recalibration signal that tells you that you are now aware of the fact that you were not knowledgeable previously about a situation that existed as a potential for you to make very, very effective action that would be highly profitable for gene survival. And that now that you are making that action and you are getting fantastic feedback, in other words, it's extremely successful feedback. This is basically like you invest in a stock and it goes at 50% in a week, and you're incredibly excited, okay? The reason you have that excitement is to tell you, wow, you didn't realize this, but this is an exceptional deal. You need to invest more time and energy in trying to make this thing happen repetitively. So that's what the beginnings of a romance is like, wow, we didn't know this person existed. They didn't know that we existed. They are willing to mate with us. This looks like a fantastic deal. And therefore, it energizes the system into attempting to repeat, you know, and have this recurrent exchange process take place. It's a signal of underinvestment in that potential, and therefore to underscore that we should put more energy into that. It's the exact opposite situation as what takes place in depression, which is signaling to you that you should put less energy and investment into the same behaviors that you've been doing. So when I hear somebody, so as I tell them this story, and I tell them the story through the eyes of some little person who's trying to secure a mate, they're trying to make friends, they're trying to get a good situation with respect to their job, and what they have in their mind is a little thing called the esteem meter, which is keeping track of the signals that they get from these different markets. And when they get good signals, it creates happiness. And when they get bad signals, it creates sadness or depression. And when they get signals that seem just reasonable, but they're neither particularly exciting or depressing, it means that it's hitting expectation. And that when people are struggling, when they're in trouble, they're getting negative feedback. They're getting negative esteem signals from some of these markets. And our job is to figure out why. Now, when I explain this, people can always tell me which the market is. They'll tell me it's my husband. They'll tell me it's my, you know, it's my friends. They'll tell me it's my job. They'll tell me it's all three. They'll tell me it's two out of the three. Nobody stares at this thing and says, I don't see any problems with any of these parts of my life, but I feel depressed. It's never happened. Okay? So the system has sufficient intuition that it can quickly spot where its life is struggling. And then what we do is we go into the explanation that these situations are timeless problems of competition. And that when I start to speak about competition in these markets, everybody understands exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, so everybody understands intuitively that we compete. And these are sort of words and a language and a way of looking at human problems that is very atypical for psychotherapy. I've never heard of a psychotherapist talking about competition and these sorts of dynamics. They actually tend to avoid this kind of discussion. And people are actually riveted, and they are very interested, because now I'm talking to what I call their source code. In other words, the system actually recognizes its own architecture when you start to name it. And so when we start talking about competition and we start talking about depression as a result of esteem signals that are negative from places that we expected it to be better, everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about, okay? And then when we go on and we talk about the self-esteem mechanism, which is a little bit different and a little bit more complicated, it all makes sense. So people are motivated to learn to the extent that they can sniff that the learning that they're going to do may be helping them be more successful, okay? And if we can't couch it in those terms, then we're going to fail to get their attention and motivation to think.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense, and that's, I mean, exactly sort of what the message I was getting as you were talking was this sort of, people are motivated to learn when they have a problem, and you can apply it to one of their sort of core priorities.
Yeah, and those are the core priorities. Sometimes there's another core priority that I will sometimes wind up addressing in the nature of my work is health. And so once in a while, you know, that's not a social psychological priority. That's just between them and the Grim Reaper. And so that is that's another one that will get people's attention. But almost always the core priorities are these three.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting? I'll just ask you this and then drop off and just sort of listen to your answer. But You know, I come to the vegan world through the animal rights ethics side, and I've always been aware of the health thing and only recently gotten more interested in and listened to all your talks and other people's sort of information on it. And I understand why it's persuasive. It just doesn't, I'm just not that interested in it. Like, I mean,
sure.
It's great for, like, people who are, and I think it's a great motivational tool, but it just doesn't do it for me the way that, like, saying I'm going to go protect an animal who someone has really harmed and is torturing. So listening to this whole explanation, which, as I said, makes a lot of sense, and I think it's exactly where some of these more difficult, complex topics don't land when you either don't have a motivated subject or you can't connect it to a problem that they're motivated to solve. I'm sort of thinking about this through the lens of how do you get people, like, how do you apply that sort of thinking to that problem of, you know, the animal ethics, right? I mean, is it an issue of just having people understand that the problem really is that bad? I mean, your point about guilt made me think, well, maybe that's some way in, but that seems like, wow, that can get really tiresome quickly if you're the voice of reminding them how guilty they are for causing all this suffering. But I think, you know, it makes the nature of that problem extra difficult because it's hard to really, I mean, evolutionarily in our past, right, we've always been sort of thinking about gathering as many resources as we can and protecting the tribe and all that. And now we're in this world where there's these complex environmental issues and this industrial farming issue from an ethical point of view seems to not quite fit into one of those easy hooks. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. And I'll, like I said, I'll drop off and listen to your answer. But thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you for the call, Lee.
Yeah, it's great. Really, really thoughtful.
Now we've got another caller on the line as well. So after you finish the answer, we'll take him.
Yeah, Lee's question. I mean, she's looking around for a lever, and hoping to find one in evolutionary psychology because it makes sense to her that if we can understand the levers of motivation, maybe there's something. There's a bet that we are missing. If you're an animal rights activist, for example, is there a lever that you can hit? And the answer is there probably is. And when I look at human beings, probably the most obvious lever is straight sensory data. And so this is what John Robbins did with Diet for a New America, the video that he shot, I don't know, 30 years ago. That probably had more influence than just about anything else that's ever been done, because we saw real live animal suffering, and it freaked out all kinds of people. A lot of people saw that movie once, and it changed their lives forever. So I think that that's probably, if you're an animal rights person, probably the grisly demonstration or a variety of video. Demonstrations of, and even, for example, the video bonding with particular animals, or even cartoon levels of it. This is how it is that I would approach those problems if this were my thing. I think that she's intuiting something that is right on target. Talking about statistics, talking about how awful things are, trying to broaden the problem into pollution, which people aren't really going to care very much about. In general, no, I think that you have to go right into the Stone Age brain, and they have to get the idea that they are, that animals that they would love, that would be part of their coalition, are being brutally treated and slaughtered unnecessarily so, and that has to be visual and vivid, and that is if I were at the head of those movements. That is exactly where all my attention would go. It would be in the production of video to tell those stories. All right. Let's
Fantastic.
Take our next caller and see if we've got something interesting we can do.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dr. Lau, you're a lot better than that other psychologist we just heard at the audio clip at the start of the show.
Yeah, but at least I got more to say.
Yeah. $3 an hour. $3 for 3 minutes.
He's extremely likable, though. Go ahead. Let's see who we got.
All right. We have caller Mike. Mike, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Dr. Lyle, from your view of evolutionary psychology, which is really just psychology, but like you said, because so many silly people out there, you have to say, you know, throw that in there. But
yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? I've never had a girlfriend or female family member who's ever been interested in talking deeply about science or philosophy, but males will talk about it hours upon hours. What's your thoughts on the difference between the male versus the female brain in this context? Like, why aren't there more females and female physicists? It's dominated by males. There are some, but more females are in the social sciences versus the pure sciences. And don't worry about what social justice warriors or feminists have to say. Just be honest, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
This is a freaking beautiful question. And I hate to disappoint Mike, but I don't know the answer. I have no doubt that the answer is genetic. In other words, I actually think some work has been done on this topic. I think, for example, some of these topics involve mathematics, and we're going to find, in other words, deep study of some of these things require facility with mathematics, and we're going to find that there's male-female differences in mathematics. So at the highest level, high facility of mathematics is going to be more common in males than it's going to be in females. This is just because the bell curve, the distributions of mental abilities are not equal. Females are better verbally. And males are better mathematically, and that doesn't mean that an awful lot of females aren't better than an awful lot of males, and vice versa with respect to these issues, but we're talking about bell curves and that overlap. And so so when you start talking about who is competent to easily deal with some very sophisticated things, for example, in theoretical physics, you're going to find that many times more males are capable of doing that kind of sophisticated thinking than there will be females. So, however, what we're really talking about and his big question, and I don't think it has as much to do with ability as it does to do with desire. It has to do with the nature of the minds and what they find inherently interesting. And so I believe that, and like I said, it's probably already known to some extent, there's probably already some pretty good evidence, but I think females are much more sort of relational oriented, subtle, you know, in terms of their interest in social dynamics and keeping track of social dynamic processes. In many ways, I think males are a little bit more interested in building blocks and hand axes and the processes and procedures of those sorts of building things. And so I think that we're going to see that this is an example of content, of natural selection, selecting for brains that have differences in interest in terms of content. So one of the more interesting things that I see is that obviously they have lifetime television, and they call it lifetime television for women. And it's stories about relationships and et cetera. And whereas men are, you know, I think that if we were to find who is watching ESPN, I think that we're going to find that probably 80 to 90% or more of the eyeball hours that are staring at ESPN are going to be male. And these are not an accident. And so that's the best that I can do. But I believe the inferences that our friend is making are effectively valid. These are natural differences in content interest, and I think that those are associated with the masculinity and femininity of brains.
Yeah, I think a few shows back, in the early beginnings of the show, there was a question from one of the listeners who asked if men are smarter than women. Or if men are more capable than women. I think what you had mentioned was that that men are just they're much more motivated to display such because the reward, if they do display their characteristics, is they get to sleep with a lot more people. They get more status in the village. Whereas whereas women,
that's not necessarily true.
Right.
Absolutely. No, there's just to be clear, and I could just see when I said, yeah, when you said men are smarter than women, I said, yeah, let's just be clear. Like, I could just see that voice clip put on the internet somewhere that I said, yeah, that was not true. No, men are not smarter than women on average. The brains are not the same. They are overlapping bell curves of capability along these different content domains that have been discovered by work in intelligence testing. And so we know that the brains are configured differently, and we know that the women are superior when it comes to vocabulary. And we actually have a great theory of, I believe it's Jeffrey Miller is probably responsible for this theory, but he may not be, about the notion that much of natural IQ testing has to do with talking to people and to listening to their vocabularies. And so men would have been highly motivated to show off their vocabularies to women. And in doing so, they're trying to get into their pants, but the women have more to lose by being had by a guy who's bluffing his vocabulary. And so therefore, we believe that women may have been naturally selected to make sure they've got a bigger vocabulary than the male does so that they can catch the bluffing and therefore discount the estimates of IQ that come from a person who's bluffing. And believe me, there's been many times when I've been in front of people that I was trying to impress, where I was searching for a word and I thought I kind of knew what a really fancy word would be, and I thought it fit, but I wasn't sure. and I really thought about using it, but I didn't want to be wrong. And so we've all been there. And so we believe that women have higher verbal intelligence as a result of having more to lose by being bluffed. And so, and correspondingly, the male probably, with respect to problems of being of hunting, in other words, trajectories and vectors, vector analysis of different sort of problems there, much further from home, et cetera, they probably have more sophisticated mathematical engineering minds built to solve those types of problems, and that translates into the modern world into engineering, you know, and the female intuition problems translate more into you know, the social science arena. So I think that that's what's going on.
Yeah, there's a George Lopez. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a comedian.
Yeah. Yeah,
he always says that when I'm struggling to, he's always struggling to find a fancy word. He just says basically because it just sounds really fancy.
Very good, very good. I'm going to keep it easy on you. We're just going to call it basically.
Yeah.
My goodness, it's beautiful.
Well, Dr. Lau, this was great. You know, we've played this clip before, but this is how we always feel when we listen to you.
It's a funny kind of a thing, but, you know, I feel better after I got all that off my chest. I feel like a load. A load is off my shoulders. You're good. Doc, thank you.
Mr. Reed, I didn't do anything.
Oh, you did something.
No, I did nothing.
You did something.
I didn't.
The load, gone. Where is it? Don't know. You're good. Nah. You're good, Doc. You're good. I'm going to begin to touch with you. Oh, just one more thing. If I talk to you and you turn me into a fag, I'm going to kill you. You understand?
Could we define fag?
Very, very good.
As always, right, Dr. Lau. And, of course, if anybody wants to talk to Dr. Lau, just esteemdynamics.org is your website, and just great consultations there, lots of good videos, audio clips, et cetera. So, Dr. Lau, thanks very much.
As always,
very
good. Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.